Okay. Parshas Pekudei, page 530. Can I put that one on also? It's a bit hot, huh? Oops. Okay, so what I want to do is a few things of Parshas Pekudei. Parshas Pekudei is the last Parsha. Page 530. Parshas Pekudei is the last Parsha that deals with the Mishkan. It's like a sum up, a conclusion. I want to do a few things on the beginning of Parshas Pekudei and then take you on a bit of a journey of Parshas Pekudei connected with Purim and Adar and get you into the Purim spirit a little bit, connected to the Parsha. Before we do that, however, this week, just to mention, I know we've done this in the past, but just to go through it briefly, because it's always important to understand how it works. This Shabbos also begins the beginning of the four special portions, what we call the Arba Parshis, the four special Parshis, which we take our two Sefer Torahs, and we read an additional portion after the Parsha of the week, right? Now, these four Parshis always begin either the Shabbos before Rosh Chodesh Adar, or if Rosh Chodesh Adar is on Shabbos, then it begins on the Shabbos, right? Now it always takes place over 5 or 6 weeks, right? It's called the four parshas, but it's never consecutive. There's always one or sometimes two breaks in the middle. This year there's only one break in the middle. The reason is because the four parshas have to be placed in a certain way. What do I mean? So let's just go through them briefly so you get an understanding, and then we'll go to the parsha of the week. So this week's special parsha is Parsha Shekalim. It's the parsha dealing with a half a shekel, which is interesting because we just had the mitzvah in the Torah a few weeks ago on the parsha, but nevertheless, as a special parsha, it's this week. And the reason that it's read this week is because the yearly tax of the half a shekel was used in the time of the temple to buy new korbanot, new sacrifices every year. And the way it worked is it worked on a cycle. So every year, the new animals, the new fund, had to be used from the beginning of Nisan, the Rosh Chodesh Nisan. So from Rosh Chodesh Nisan, they bought animals for the temple, the new animals from the new fund of that year, right? And what they would do is they would give themselves a month to collect that tax. So it says in the Gemara that on the first day of Adar, they would announce that it's time to give the half a shekel, and they would spend the month of Adar collecting the half a shekel. Which is why every year, to remember that, because we do many things to remember the temple, when we read the Parsha of the Week on the Shabbos before the beginning of Adar, or on the first of Adar itself, if it's a Shabbos, we read that mitzvah of giving half a shekel, right? So that's where it's got to be placed. The next Parsha is Parsha Zachor, which always has to be the Shabbos before Purim. That's the mitzvah to remember Amalek. There's a mitzvah to hear the Parsha once a year, to having in mind to remember what Amalek did to us in the midst of wiping them out, etc. And it's designated Shabbos to do that is Shabbos before Purim, because the whole story of Purim is connected with Amalek, because Haman, of course, was a descendant of Amalek, right? But we always do it the Shabbos before Purim. So, for example, this year, when it's Purim's on a Sunday, so therefore there you have that break between this week's Parsha Shekalim, and we have the following Parsha, we don't do anything special, and then the following week will be the one before Purim, where we read that Parsha Zachor, right? Then it works that the third one is the Parshat Parah, the one that deals with the red heifer. And that's also to remember what used to happen in the time of the temple, because around this time of the year, getting close to Pesach, every Jew had to become pure from being in contact with a dead body, because they had to go up to the Beit HaMikdash and bring the Paschal offering, the Korban Pesach. So that's why we read the Parshat Parah, the Parshat that deals with the purification of impurity having to do with the dead body, and that's always read around this time of the year. When is it placed? So it's always placed the week just before the fourth Parsha, which is a Chodesh, where we read about the making the calendar, Rosh Chodesh Nisan, and the mitzvah of Korban Pesach. When is a Chodesh read? So a Chodesh is always read on either the first of Nisan, if it's Shabbos, or the Shabbos before the first of Nisan, because it deals with Rosh Chodesh Nisan. Right? So whenever the Parsha of a Chodesh is, the week just before that will be Parshas Parah. It says between the third and the fourth, we do it always consecutively. This year it works out that there's no break after Purim. Sometimes after Purim there's another Shabbos you have to wait, and then two parshas. So this week it's done over 5 weeks. This year it's done over 5 weeks. We have Shkalim, a break, Zachor, Para and Chachodesh. Just to give you an overview of the four parashas. What's interesting is that there's many, we're not going to do it today, maybe one of the weeks we'll try and explore this, but halachically and historically, these four parashas have nothing to do with each other. Meaning the only two that have yes to do with each other is the one about the cow and the red heifer and Parashat HaChodesh. Because they connect because they both have to do with the Korban Pesach. Zachor has to do with the mitzvah of Amalek. Shkalim has to do with the story of giving half a shekel. They're actually not connected. However, everything is by divine providence. Nothing happens by chance. And because they come together as a cluster, and they are called the Arba Parshiyot, they're called the four Parshas, there's a lot of commentary that actually does connect them, and there's a lot of philosophical and Kabbalistic connections, and therefore they do form sort of one formula. But we'll try and maybe spend a bit of time on that on a different share. Okay. Back to the Parsha of the week. So this Parsha is an interesting Parsha. It's the Parsha of, it's the audit. The audit and the accounts. Right? It's like the end of the financial year kind of thing, of the Mishkan, of building the Mishkan. Let's have a look at what the Pasuk says, and then we'll try and unravel some of the concepts. So the Pasuk says the following. Eile pekudei ha-mishkan. Right? These are the reckonings, these are the accounts of the Mishkan. Don't forget, it was coming all together. The Mishkan was being put together, and it's time to give an audit. So it says, these are the accounts of the Mishkan. Mishkan ha-edus, which the Mishkan is called the tabernacle of testimony. Asher pukad api Moshe, these accounts were counted out, were given, were submitted by Moshe, together with avodas halavim, together with the service of the levim, the Levites helped him out. The Yad Isomer, which were run by Isomer ben Aaron HaKohen. So essentially what the Pasuk is saying is, Moshe Rabbeinu put together a team. The team was coordinated by himself. Then it was, second in command was Itamar, the son of Aaron HaKohen, who led a group of Levim, and together they put together this account, itemization, and sort of submission of all the donations that had taken place for the Mishkan. Then the Pasuk makes mention of who was the project manager of the Mishkan. We had this before, but the Pasuk mentions it again. Ubetzalel ben Uri ben Chur lemata Yehuda. Betzalel, the son of Uri, the son of Chur, from the tribe of Yehuda. He also is called Asher Tziva Hashem as Moshe. He did whatever Hashem commanded Moshe Rabbeinu. He implemented, he was in command, he put it all together. The Itoi Ahaliyah ben Achisamach, together with him, was a man by the name of Ahaliyah ben Achisamach, Lamate Dan, who came from the tribe of Dan. Did we talk about this last week, the contrast between the two? No? Okay, I'll tell you that in a second. Chorosh Achoshev, he was a weaver, he was a carpenter, a roikim, but the Cheles, by government, he was able to work with the materials of wool and purple, of Talas Hashonu Bashesh, crimson wool, linen, all the different types of wool. Okay. Now, just to mention that, it says, who was the project manager of the Mishkan? When Moshe Rabbeinu came down the mountain with the command to build a Mishkan, who did he put in charge? He put in charge two people. One was Bezalel, the other one was Ahaliyav. What's the difference between the two? First of all, you know, by the way, Bezalel was 13 years old at the time. I don't know if you're aware. I'm not so good at history and ages like that. The first time I heard that was when I heard a bar mitzvah speech. Someone once gave a mitzvah speech. It was telling the mitzvah boy, you know, 13 years old, you think you're only a little boy, your potential is infinite. Look at Bezalel. It must have been Parshas Truma or something. Right? It's like, boy, you know, Bezalel was only 13. If I checked that up, he's right. And, yeah. So Bezalel was only 13 years old, but he was gifted, and he was able to project manage this whole Mishkan, right? But together with him was Ahaliyah. The difference between the two is this. Bezalel came from the tribe of Yehuda. Yehuda was the majestic tribe. It was the tribe of royalty. Right? Yehuda was always in leadership position. Yehuda always led the way. When they traveled in the desert, Yehuda was the first tribe to travel. They were kind of a tribe of absolute royalty. Yehuda was the king. David HaMelech comes from Yehuda. Mashiach will come from Yehuda, etc. Dan, the next one, Ahaliyav, was from the tribe of Dan. Dan were known as the lowest of all the tribes. They were the ones who traveled last. They were the ones who produced... I think it was Michal who actually was responsible for the golden calf. They were always like the Nochschleppers. They were the guys who were on the lowest level, right? So the Torah tells us that to build a Mishkan, everyone has to get involved in building a Mishkan. Doesn't matter if you're from the tribe of Yehuda, the tribe of Dan, you're a big Yichus, you got no Yichus, you're a big guy, a small guy, you got to be involved. And the symbol of that was that who were the project managers of the Mishkan? Bezalel from Yehuda or Leah from Dan. Okay. On the topic of Bezalel, just on a side point, we'll just mention a few little things first. It says here that Bezalel ben Uri from the tribe of Yehuda, he did whatever God commanded Moshe Rabbeinu. Which actually Rashi picks up as an interesting thing. He didn't hear the command straight from Hashem. He heard it from Moshe Rabbeinu. So really what the Pasuk should have said is that Bezalel ben Uri ben Chul Matay Yehuda did whatever Moshe Rabbeinu told him was the command of God. Right? So Rashi points out an interesting medrash. That actually what happened was like this. When Moshe Rabbeinu came to Bezalel, he gave him the following command. He said, you should build a Mishkan. What you should do is, he told him first, he should build the furniture. He should build the ark. He should build the table. He should build the menorah, etc. And then he told him the commandment of building the beams and the curtains. So Bezalel said to him, I don't understand this. This is not going to work. When you build a house, you've got to build a house. Then you build the furniture. Otherwise, where's the furniture going to go? Right? So Moshe Rabbeinu told him, you're actually right. That you have such intuition and Ruach HaKodesh, actually that when God told me, he actually told me the way you're saying it. He told me first to build a Mishkan, and then to build an ark. Moshe Rabbeinu, when he communicated it to Bezalel, he talked about the ark first, because he wanted to emphasize what the purpose of the Mishkan was. Right? Because unlike a normal building, where the purpose is the building, not the furniture, with the Mishkan, it actually was the other way around. In the Mishkan, the purpose was the furniture, not the building. Meaning, the furniture was what the purpose was, that it was the representation of a divine presence, it was the altar to bring sacrifices, that was the purpose of the Mishkan, the house was just somewhere for it all to happen. But actually the furniture was the tachlis, was the goal, that's why Moshe Rabbeinu said that first, right? But actually in terms of actually building it, you build the building first, then you bring in the furniture, and Bezalel picked up on that. That's why the Pasuk says that Bezalel did, doesn't say Bezalel did what Moshe Rabbeinu told him, Bezalel did what Hashem told Moshe. Because that's actually what he picked up, what was the command to Moshe Rabbeinu. Yeah.
Doesn't it make you worry then that he got other stuff wrong?
No, because it was yeah, that's a good question. But first of all, it's not our business. Moshe Rabbeinu, we can question, but at the end of the day, Moshe Rabbeinu is Moshe Rabbeinu. You know, he was in charge, and that was, he was obviously the leader, and we need to listen. But it wasn't like it wasn't a mistake that he made. It was an intentional thing. That's what I'm saying. It was intentional. He did that because he wanted to emphasize what the goal was. And perhaps that rearranging the order itself was a divine command. Well, we don't know that, but Bezalel was picked it up. But it shows he only picked up that, because everything else was the way it was told.
Wasn't the purpose of the Mishkan to have a dwelling place like Shiloh rather than?
Yeah, but that was done through the furniture, not through the building so much. There's a dispute between the Ramban and the Rambam. Right, about what was the main item in the Mishkan. The Rambam says it was the altar, because he says the purpose of the Mishkan is to bring sacrifices. The Ramban says it was the ark, because the purpose of the Mishkan was to represent the divine presence. But just goes to show you that it's all about the items in the Mishkan.
So someone had that thought before
me, you say? Yeah, I'm saying it was...
Okay.
No. Okay. Now, so that's just a little bit about what the Pesukim are saying. And let's have a look at this whole thing that Moshe Rabbeinu gives a din v'cheshbon. He gives a proper audit, and he found it necessary to actually submit a proper set of accounts of what was donated, what was the total, and what it was used for. And then we're going to have a look at the accounting itself and pick up some interesting things. First of all, why did he do that? The Medrash, there's two reasons. The Medrash says that although he was Moshe Rabbeinu, but the Medrash says that actually there were groups of people who started to suspect Moshe Rabbeinu. There's always, there's always, like it always happens, that's right. So there were people that walked around the midway, that's what the Medrash says, that they said, you know, have you noticed Moshe Rabbeinu is driving a nice car these days? Didn't quite say like that, but, right? Or things like that, right? So Moshe Rabbeinu decided to make sure that he's absolutely clean, so he'll give a proper reckoning of the Mishkan. Now, why does he have to do that? But at the end of the day, he knows that he's doing the right thing. Or some say, actually, there was no suspicion. Some say it was Moshe Rabbeinu volunteered this whole process. Why would he do that? There's a very interesting concept, which is the basis of all of this. And that is that there's a pasuk, and the pasuk says, the yisem nekiim mehashem umi Yisrael, that you should be clean and pure before God and before Yisrael. Meaning, that it's not enough to do the right thing. person has an obligation to be seen to be doing the right thing also, right? Now obviously, the first foundation is you've got to do the right thing, right? It's not enough just to be seen to be doing the right thing, you have to do the right thing also. But actually, you have to be seen to be doing the right thing. Why? Because there's a very interesting concept in Yiddishkeit called Kiddush Hashem, sanctification of God's name, to sanctify God's name. The basis of that obligation is that we have a responsibility to make morality attractive. Right? It's an amazing thing. It's not enough. We don't have a responsibility to serve God, to do the mitzvahs. We have that too. Yeah, God says there's a Torah, there's mitzvahs, there's a moral code, there's a moral compass, there's a direction, there's a spiritual moral compass, there's a moral compass, there's between man and God, between man and man. These are the mitzvahs, these are the between man and man, these are between man and God. All true. But then, as human beings, we don't live alone. We have a communal responsibility. And part of that communal responsibility is we're not all leaders. We're not all people who have tremendous impact on communities and countries. But every person is a leader in their own right. Meaning, every person has a responsibility to create a sphere of influence. And that sphere of influence means that you have a responsibility to make morality and spirituality attractive. And therefore, when someone does something 100%, but creates an appearance, creates a perception that it's not right, then that person is in violation of making morality attractive. Right? And this extends to all areas of Allah, not always in our control. And there is sometimes, of course, we have to sit back and say, I know I've done the right thing and it's just too bad. That's true. But we have to try first. And it translates all areas of halacha and Yiddishkeit. It's very interesting. For example, this is the whole basis of the concept of marit ayin, right? Marit ayin is a concept in halacha that if I'm eating, for example, I'm eating a piece of steak with coconut milk. I'm just quoting an example in halacha. The halacha says I have to have a coconut on the table, so that you looking at me, you shouldn't think that I've gone mad. And I'm eating milk and meat. Why do I care if you think I've gone mad? So it's your problem. I'm not violating. I'm not violating milk and meat because I have an obligation not to be a hypocrite. But I'm not a hypocrite, I'm doing the right thing. I have an obligation not to look like a hypocrite, right? To make it attractive, so you shouldn't think, you see when it suits him, it's okay, right? So that's an interesting obligation. This goes to such lengths that in Gemara it says, listen to this, that the Kohen Gadol in Yerushalayim, someone who was appointed to the post of being a high priest, his wife didn't use perfume so that people shouldn't suspect him that he took from the incense of the Beis HaMikdash. Look, that's how far it goes. Right? He had to be married. He had to be married. Yeah. Poor woman, you're right. Sorry, you want to know?
Can we make it a bit warmer?
Yeah. So that, right? There's a thing in the Gemara like this. You know, we talk about the half a shekel. This week we're going to read the special parsha, right? So how did it work? I mean, there weren't electronic bank accounts in those days. But so all the half a shekels were collected and they were kept in a room in the temple, right? Like a safe room, I don't know, a strong room, whatever you call it. Once in a while, there were certain times of the year that there would be a guy that went into this room and he would collect these half shekels in order to bring them out and go buy sacrifices. It slipped my mind. I don't remember why only one guy could go into this room at a time. Maybe it had to do with the holiness of the Beis HaMikdash. I don't remember exactly. Maybe it was a space. But the bottom line is only one guy could go in at a time. So this guy had to go in, he had to be wearing things with no pockets. Right? He could be a great guy, he could be the tzaddik of the generation, but he had to go in without any pockets. Right? So no one should suspect that he's pocketed a half a shekel. Yeah? So much, it goes to such lengths that when he went into the room, there'd be people outside engaging him in conversation the whole time, so that he was talking the whole time, so no one should say that he put a coin in his mouth. Right, that's how extreme it is. Right? Because Torah recognizes human weakness, number one, if we always have to protect yourself, and recognizes the need to be absolutely squeaky clean. I'll give you like a little bit of a related example. I mean, it always fascinates me, this idea. You know, in olden times, you know, now this year's a leap year, right? So now we have a 19-year cycle, so we know when it's going to be leap. It's all systemized, okay. But in olden times, it wasn't that like that. In olden times, when it became the month of Adar, if it was a year where Pesach was beginning to get a bit late, or early, whatever the case, early, I mean, So they would, the Sanhedrin would convene, you know, maybe we should add another month of Adar this year. It was done on a year-by-year basis. So there was a committee of people who was in charge of making leap years. The Kohen Gadol, the high priest, was not allowed to sit in this committee. Now listen to this. Why? Because 7 months later, it's going to be Yom Kippur. On Yom Kippur, the Kohen Gadol was the one to represent the Jewish people in the service of the Beis HaMikdash, right? One of the very critical things of the Kohen Gadol on Yom Kippur is he had a very busy day. He had to go to a mikveh 5 times a day, 5 times during Yom Kippur. Now, there was no heating in those days. The mikveh was cold, right? Cold mikveh 5 times during Yom Kippur. It's autumn time in Israel. So we don't want the Kohen Gadol to be on the committee in case he might have an agenda that the leap year should be structured such a way to put Yom Kippur in a warmer season. Now, it's unbelievable because we're talking about a Kohen Gadol. Right? We're talking about a Kohen Gadol. We're talking about the high priest who presumably was a tzaddik. So he's serious, he's going to sit at the table and think about, oh, maybe. Right? So he can't sit on the committee. Either he, at the end of the day, subconsciously he might give in to some subtle human weakness, or he might be suspected of trying to engineer the leap year so that he could have a warmer mikvah on Yom Kippur. That, this is the length of Torah text. So therefore we understand why Moshe Rabbeinu says, okay, he's going to put forward, he didn't need to do it, Moshe Rabbeinu was above suspicion. It's Moshe Rabbeinu, after all, the greatest prophet that ever lived, never will live. But he leads an example and presents this detailed, specific accounting of the Mishkan, so no one should suspect it. The problem is, when we look at the accounts, an interesting thing happens. Look at this. Let's have a look. Now, I'm not going to be able to explain this all to you because I'm very bad at numbers and currencies and all like that, but just basically there's three currencies. There's a kikar, and the kikar contains a certain amount of money, and money contains a certain amount of shekels. Okay, I've forgotten the amounts now exactly. Which is why the Torah gives it to us in kikars and in shekels. Okay, so it says like this, kol hazav, all the gold, says the pasuk, if you have a look at verse 24. Kol hazav ha'asi la'melacha, all the gold that was brought and donated to the thing, v'chol melechas ha'kodesh, for all the holy work, says the pasuk, v'yihi zahav ha'tenufa, the offered up gold was teisha v'eshrim kikar, there was 29 kikar of gold, I've no idea how much that is, u'shvar me'ois u'shloshim shekel, 730 shekel, v'shekel ha'kodesh, in the holy shekel. There's two types of shekels, there's a regular shekel and there's a holy shekel. A holy shekel is worth double than a regular shekel. Okay. So it tells us there were 29 kikar of gold and 700 and whatever it is, 30 shekel that was given in gold. That was the account for the gold. That's how much gold was contributed to the Mishkan. But it doesn't tell us what the gold was used for just yet. Okay. Then the pasuk continues and says like this, the kesef pekudei ha'eda, the silver. Now there was different silver that was given. There was the half a shekel and the regular silver. Anyway, ma'as kikar was 100 kikar. So, b'kesef kudei ha'eda, ma'as kikar 100 kikar. Ve'elach shvah ma'oyz chamisha v'shivim shekel, there was 1,775 shekel b'shekel ha'kodesh. And then the next pasuk, okay, we can skip on the next verse, just tells us that it was given by all the people that were took a census. And go to pasuk chav zayin 27. It says like this, v'ehi ma'as kikar ha'kesef, 100 of the kikar of kesef was latzekes adne hakodesh, was to make the sockets. Okay, I think I've told you this a few weeks ago. When they built the beams of the Mishkan, the foundation of the Mishkan was these heavy silver sockets, and that was made from the half shekels that was donated. The ace adne haparoches, and it was made for the sockets of the thing. Ma'asa donin, there was 100 sockets. Le ma'asa kikar, for 100 kikar, kikar la oden, 1 kikar of silver was used for each socket. Okay. Then the pasuk says es ha'elef. The 1,000 ushva me'oyz v'chamisha v'shivim, the 1,775 shekel of silver. What do they do with that silver? Asa vavim la'amudim. They made hooks for the pillars. The tzipa roshayim. They covered their tops. The chishak oisam, and they banded them. Whatever that means. What are these hooks? Just so you understand, the courtyard of the Mishkan You'll see why this is relevant in a minute. The courtyard of the Mishkan was, the actual interior of the Mishkan was these beams that were made, pushed together, and it was a wall made out of wooden beams. The courtyard was pillars, spaced pillars, which was covered by a curtain. And a curtain was hung upon these pillars. These curtains were hung on silver hooks, which were hanging just behind the pillar, and then the curtain was hooked onto these hooks, and that made the courtyard of the Mishkan. Okay, it might even actually be a little picture of someone, so you see what I'm talking about. Give me a second. Yeah, go to page 463, you'll see what I'm saying. Okay, 463, see that? Mm-hmm. So the out, in other words, the courtyard of the Mishkan, you see those pillars, those spaced pillars, and that light grey area, that's a curtain. And that, how did that hang? That hung on these hooks that were attached to these wooden pillars, and these hooks were silver hooks, and they were made from the 1,775 shekel of silver. Okay. Then the pasuk goes, okay, and does the same thing with the copper. I'm not going to go through the whole thing now, but it says the copper was 70 kikar and 2,000, whatever it is, and it tells us exactly what the copper was used for. So, the question is this. What happens here is, Moshe Rabbeinu presents the accounts. He says, this is how much gold was donated. He doesn't say what the gold was used for. And he says, this is what the silver was used for, donated, and he says what the silver was used for, and the copper, and he gives what the copper was used for. The obvious question is, if you want to give a fair account, if you want to give a real honest account above all suspicion, so why did he hide what the gold was used for? Why didn't he give an itemized list of what the gold was used for, as he did with the silver and as he did with the copper? Okay. So there's a Kli Yakar. The Kli Yakar is one of the commentaries of the Parsha. And he says the following. He says that the reason that he did that was because, let's see where it's placed in the Chumash. What happened was, at this point, at the beginning of Pekudei, we just read in Parshas Vayakel, last week's Parsha, that the whole Mishkan was made. All the furniture was made, the beams were made, the curtains were made, it was all done. What wasn't yet made was the garments of the Kohanim. But Moshe Rabbeinu didn't want to wait for the accounts until that was all made. He wanted, as soon as the Mishkan was ready, he wanted to give a set of accounts. Therefore, says the Kli Yakar, he could give the copper and the silver, but he couldn't give the gold, because some of the gold was still going to be used in the priestly garments, because if you remember about the priestly garments, they were made out of very fancy threads, which contained gold. Golden threads, which were beaten from gold and cut very thin, and they became golden threads, and they were made into the priestly garments, so therefore the gold wasn't actually finished. We knew how much was donated, but it hasn't been finished what was used for yet. So therefore, at this point, Moshe Rabbeinu couldn't yet give an itemized reckoning of what happened to the gold. He could just say what was contributed. What he could do, he could do it with the silver and he could do it with the copper, and that's why he did that.
Was there gold in the Choshen also?
Yep, there was. Right. The problem with that is, that's all very good, but the problem is, so why didn't he do it later then? Okay, so why don't we see later at the end of Pekudei, when the priestly garments are all made, why did Moshe Rabbeinu say, okay, just going to finish up now, the gold's been properly used now, this is the itemized accounts of what the gold was used for. And he doesn't do that. He doesn't come back and complete the accounts. So a number of reasons. One reason is, brought down in the commentaries, that actually the gold was a whole mystery altogether. Why? Because actually, if you tally up the gold, and I don't know how to do this well because this is not my area, but if you tally up the gold, it was relatively a very small amount of gold that was donated. And in fact, the question becomes not what the gold was used for, the question becomes how on earth did they manage to make all these golden things with so little gold? Right? So there's actually a whole problem with the gold. No, so much gold was used. If you look at how much gold was used, I mean, the amount of gold used was enormous. They covered all the beams with gold. They covered the Mizbeach with gold. They made a small altar purely out of gold. The menorah was purely out of gold. The aron was purely out of gold. The shulchan was purely out of gold. It was an amazing amount of gold was used. And they were heavy things. They were thick. They were heavy. The kerubim was made out of gold. It was an amazing amount of gold used. If you take the dimensions, if you know what the calculations are with the kikars, and then you take the measurements of all these various vessels, you know there was much more gold was used that was donated. So the question is where that gold come from. In other words, it's obvious that the Jews were enthusiastic about donating to the Mishkan, but they obviously didn't have that much gold with them. They had lots of things they took out of Egypt, but they actually, relatively speaking, had a limited supply of gold. So where did it come from? So we see two sources of two solutions to that problem. One is that Moshe Rabbeinu himself supplemented it. Moshe Rabbeinu had gold himself. He also came out of Mitzrayim. In fact, there's a pasuk that says that Moshe Rabbeinu himself was wealthy. So he supplemented the gold out of his own pocket. Which is why, says the Mefarshim, that he didn't have any necessity to give an account for the gold, because everyone knew, no one suspected him for the gold. Because it was obvious that the gold, whatever gold was donated, was used. In fact, it was obvious that Moshe Rabbeinu had supplemented more gold than that donated, so no one had a problem with the gold, so that was totally unnecessary. Or, other commentaries say that actually the whole thing was miraculous. That the kelim, the vessels of the Mishkan, were actually miraculous. That there was a bit of gold made to use vessels and furniture that was much more than was much bigger than was donated. The miracle was obvious, and no one had a problem with the gold.
What happened to the gold from the golden calf?
No, that's what the Zohar says. The golden calf itself was destroyed.
But how do you destroy gold?
They grounded it and threw it into the river or something. But that, you see, the Zohar says that gold actually came from the jewelry. That was a different source of gold. If you look at the parasha of the golden calf, that was personal jewelry on their body that they used.
Where did this gold come from?
This was gold they'd taken out of Mitzrayim. They borrowed and taken out golden vessels from their neighbors and stuff, you know, because they left Mitzrayim. They had to borrow, they had to take vessels and stuff. That was part of the commandment. They had to come out with wealth.
And they didn't use that for the gold.
No. Why they didn't use it for the golden calf is a question. That's why the Zohar holds. We did this last week. The Zohar says that they actually have contributed to the Mishkan before the golden calf. Yeah. Not everyone abused the Zohar, but that's one of the Zohar's proofs. Yeah. Because that's why they have to give Julia the hat, because they've given everything away for the Mishkan.
And one more question.
Yeah?
So then why did they make all the main utensils of gold if that's so heavy, and they made the Mishkan so lightweight?
Because that was the mitzvah. The mitzvah was to make out of gold. It says in the Torah.
It's pretty heavy.
It was very heavy gold. The whole thing was miraculous. That if you look at Arya Kaplan's Chumash, you'll see also that the whole, like the Oran, it's made out of pure gold. I don't know what pure, right? Pure gold is the highest level of purity. You'll actually know that if you look at the dimensions of the Oran, scientifically it was impossible to stand. It would have sagged. The whole thing would have fallen in with that amount of pure gold. So the whole thing was, that's another proof that the vessels of the Mishkan were actually a miraculous phenomenon. Anyway. So that's one answer. Then there's another answer. And the answer goes like this. There's a very interesting medrash, which we're going to deal with a little bit later as well, but let's have a look at this medrash. You go back a second to when they give an itemized thing for the silver. Have a look at... one second. Yeah, on page 532, the Pasuk Chaf Ches, 28, verse 28, right? Where it says... We found that the silver was used for two things. One thing the silver was used for was to build the sockets, and the other thing was built was made to make these hooks, these silver hooks, right? So it says that the 100 kikar was used to make 100 sockets, right? Then the pasuk says, and the 1,775 shekel remaining silver was made for the hooks. The problem with this pasuk is the. It says ha'elef, the thousand. What do you mean the thousand? Why don't you just say 100 kikar for this, 1,775 for this? What's the 1,775? So there's a very fascinating medrash, and the medrash says that when Moshe Rabbeinu presented the accounts of the silver, he gave the account of what the 100 kikar was used for. Then there was 775 shekel left over, and Moshe Rabbeinu went blank. He couldn't remember what it was used for. Which got him into trouble, of course. So what do you mean? It's not around, but... All right. And a heavenly voice came out and reminded everyone that it was used, that it's 100% clean. The The 1,775 shekel were used to make the hooks of the pillars of the Azara. That's what the Medrash says. Right? Once everyone saw that the heavenly voice is intervening here and testifying to the fact that Moshe Rabbeinu is above suspicion, everyone calmed down. The Kli Yakar says, if that's the case, that's why Moshe Rabbeinu didn't have to give a reckoning later for the gold. Because once he presented these accounts, and that happened to him, and when as soon as it happened to him, a heavenly voice came to his assistance, people gave up and they said, okay, we don't need a rest, we don't need the rest of the accounts. So he finished off what he was doing here in terms of gold, silver, and copper, but later on it became unnecessary to go back and give an itemized account of the gold, because everyone saw that this is a heavenly thing, and it's not a problem. Right? That's why, that's the two answers why we don't find that he had to come back later and give an itemized account of the gold. Yeah, wasn't it? You know, there's a medrash that says that when Moshe Rabbeinu was told to appoint leaders, you know, the Sanhedrin, the 70 elders. So there's a medrash that says that God told Moshe Rabbeinu to go and tell them that if you think I'm giving you positions of honor, tell them that it's not that way. I'm giving you positions of slavery. Right? Sharani not alecha. I'm giving you office. I'm giving you slavery. Okay. Communal work was never the, you know. Okay. However, what I wanted to pick up on is this medrash. This is a fascinating medrash. What does this mean that Moshe Rabbeinu forgot what the 1,775 shekel was used for? I mean, this wasn't that complicated. Right? And suddenly he went blank. It was a total blank for him. He couldn't remember that the shekel was used for the hooks. Why? Why did that happen to him? Right? The other question is, if it did happen to him, and a heavenly voice had to come to his assistance, which then saved him from having to do the gold accounts later, why didn't the heavenly voice just come out in the beginning and say, listen guys, everything is fine. Don't worry about the accounts. So that, the Mefarshim explained, is a very good reason for that, because actually Hashem wanted him to present accounts. Hashem wanted him to teach us this lesson, that it's important to be clean. It's important to be above suspicion. Okay. But let's go back to the actual medrash. Like, why did it happen to him? So I wanted to spend the next 20 minutes on this following idea, which I saw in a book called Emunas Itecha. I've quoted from before. He's a rabbi that actually lives in Barpak today, and he gives fascinating shiurim. He wrote books, and he comes up with the most creative novel ideas based on different books of Kabbalah, etc. So I'm going to share with you something that he writes, with a couple of extra things in the middle. First of all, there's an amazing piece in a book, a Kabbalistic book called Megale Amukos. Megale Amukos was a Kabbalist. His name was Rabbi Nota Neta Shapiro or something. And he lived in Poland in the 16th century. A tremendous, tremendous Kabbalist. He actually wrote a very famous book called Megale Amukos. And in fact, it's a book giving, I forgot what it is, hundreds of commentary on one particular parsha of the Torah, Parshas Vayetzanan. And he comes up with, he's got amazing, amazing stuff there. In fact, on his tomb, it says that it was well known that he communicated with Eliyahu HaNavi, and he learned Kabbalah with Elijah the prophet himself, and amazing things happened. He was an amazing, amazing person. And it's considered a very, very authoritative source of Kabbalistic work. So the Megale Amukos quotes this Medrash, that Moshe Rabbeinu forgot, right? He forgot what the remaining silver was used for, and then it was revealed to him that it was used for the hooks hanging on the pillars of the courtyard. He adds a little bit to it, and he said what happened was, based on sources of Kabbalah, he says, what happened was, at that point of time, he says, the soul of Rabbi Akiva was revealed to Moshe Rabbeinu, and the soul of Rabbi Akiva revealed to Moshe Rabbeinu that the silver was used for the hooks. Right? Which makes this whole medrash much more cryptic now. Like, how did Rabbi Akiva get into the picture? What is that all about? Why Rabbi Akiva? What's the connection? What's going on?
And still, why he forgot.
And why he forgot. Why did it have to be revealed to him in that way? And why the hooks? What's the significance of the hooks? And why Rabbi Akiva? Okay. So listen to this. First, we need to understand the relationship between Rabbi Akiva and Moshe Rabbeinu. We know the famous, there's a famous concept. Rabbi Akiva was known as a continuation of Moshe Rabbeinu, and yet revealed things that Moshe Rabbeinu himself was unable to reveal within himself. What does that mean? So, we find, for example, the famous Medrash that Moshe Rabbeinu was given a vision of all future generations. And he saw Rabbi Akiva giving a shir. Right? Famous Medrash. He saw Rabbi Akiva giving a shir. And Rabbi Akiva was teaching concepts of Torah that Moshe Rabbeinu didn't know himself. Right? And he felt faint. Here's Moshe Rabbeinu. He's possibly the one that received the Torah. And he sees in a vision Rabbi Akiva's teaching concepts that he doesn't know. And he felt faint, says the Medrash. Suddenly he hears in the future vision, in the prophetic vision, he hears one of the students of Rabbi Akiva ask Rabbi Akiva, how do you know this? So Rabbi Akiva says, Halacha l'Moshe mi-Sinai. It's a tradition for Moshe Rabbeinu at Sinai. So Moshe Rabbeinu felt better. Like, oh, so this has got to do with, it's the same Torah. It's like, it's not a new thing that wasn't given to me, right? What does all this mean? We find sometimes, I'll give you an example. It says that Adam Arishan, the first man, was going to live for 1,000 years. And that Adam Arishan had a vision that David HaMelech, King David, was going to be born a stillborn. Right, it's famous Gemara. And it would be a problem because the whole of future destiny of the world depends on David HaMelech, because Mashiach has to come from King David, right? So it says that Adam Arishan gave away 70 of his years to David HaMelech, and therefore David HaMelech lived 70 years. And if you look in the Chumash, that's why Adam HaRishon only lives 930 years. He was the first man who was supposed to live 1,000 years, and he only lives 930 years because he gave away 70 years to King David. Famous question. What does this all mean? I mean, he was supposed to be stillborn, but he got his years from King. Either David HaMelech was going to live, or he wasn't going to live. What did he need the years from Adam HaRishon for, right? So there's a famous explanation that goes like this. Adam HaRishon was a symbol of absolute purity. Adam HaRishon was he was created and fashioned and designed by the hands of God. In fact, in the Hebrew terminology for it, he's called Yitzir Kapav Shel HaKadosh Baruch Hu. He was the handiwork of God himself. Right? So therefore, Adam HaRishon became the one, the carrier of all future souls, we are told. He was the source of purity, the source of souls. Right? Which was precisely his problem. Why? Because Adam HaRishon was so pure that as soon as he interacted with something that was negative, his whole world fell apart. As soon as there was a temptation from the Nachash, as soon as there was a temptation from the other side, so to speak, from the negative side, Adam HaRishon couldn't work that through. He fell apart. He failed. Him and Chava. Right? Ultimately, the greatness of God's world is that God will be revealed and manifested in every aspect of creation. The purpose of creation is that God's reality, that God's presence should be revealed and be manifested in the lowest of the low, which will be the job of Mashiach. That's why if you have a look at Mashiach, Mashiach is the exact opposite of Adam HaRishon. Right? We've gone through this once before, we don't have time to go in great detail now, but Mashiach, his ancestry is anything but pure. Mashiach comes from Lot and his daughters. Mashiach comes from Yehuda, the story of Yehuda and Tamar, Ruth and Boaz, David HaMelech, who was always, he's a problem because his father had a maidservant, or whatever, whole business. Right? Every story that has to do with the ancestry of Mashiach is problematic. King David himself had a rough life, a life of absolute tzaras. You look at Tehillim, you know why Tehillim is so powerful? Because it's full of tzaras. Full, from beginning to end. And it's David HaMelech working through the challenges of life, right? That's why David HaMelech has to be the one to be the ancestor of Mashiach. David HaMelech was the power that was so strong, even stronger than Adam HaRishon, that he could elevate even the lowest of the low. That's the soul of King David. But you cannot begin with challenge. You've got to begin with a model of purity. So David HaMelech's years have to be taken from Adam HaRishon. But Adam HaRishon cannot do what David HaMelech can do. So it's a partnership. You understand? Yeah. Same thing with Moshe Rabbeinu and Rabbi Akiva. Moshe Rabbeinu was the symbol of Torah. He was the greatest prophet. He was a symbol of absolute purity. Rabbi Akiva is known as like a second Moshe Rabbeinu. Rabbi Akiva was known as the as the authority of the oral Torah. Rabbi Akiva was able to take little crowns of the letters of the Torah and discover within them great halachas. That's what it says in the Gemara, right? Rabbi Akiva's whole source was Moshe Rabbeinu, but yet he was able to go even further than Moshe Rabbeinu. He was able to discover things that even Moshe Rabbeinu wasn't able to discover. And what do we mean? So we mean like this. Have a look at the name Rabbi Akiva. The name Rabbi Akiva has the word, the source of the root of the word Akiva is Akev, the heel. Rabbi Akiva to Moshe Rabbeinu was a bit like King David to Adam HaRishon. His connection was through Torah. He was able to learn Torah and study Torah only through his connection to Moshe Rabbeinu, but he was able to descend lower into lower levels that Moshe Rabbeinu couldn't descend into. Now, let's develop this so you understand where it all comes from. We are taught that every soul, there are 12 tribes, correct? The 12 tribes, we are taught, are connected to the name of Hashem, Yud-Kei Vav-Kei, which you know that we always say this, that Yud-Kei Vav-Kei, the name of God, has 12 permutations, right? You're aware of this concept, right? 12 permutations, the 12 permutations correspond to 12 months, correspond to 12 tribes, etc. Every soul has a connection to one letter in the Torah. Because our connection to God is through the Torah. So it says that every soul has a letter in the Torah. There's about 600,000 souls, meaning 600,000 categories of souls, and every category of soul is connected to one letter in the Torah. There are certain souls, however, that become, with time, trapped and entangled in such negativity, in such impurity, that although we normally know that a person can always do tshuva, a person can always reconnect, etc., etc., but there are certain souls that fall so low that they become trapped in such levels of impurity that it appears like they've dropped off and they have no redemption. They appear to be souls beyond redemption. But these souls still have a connection. In fact, Kabbalistically, even these souls are connected to letters in the Torah. But which letters in the Torah? So he brings from a source of Kabbalah that we have, at the end of the Torah, there are 8 verses where Moshe Rabbeinu dies. That according to many opinions, Moshe Rabbeinu didn't even write those sentences. The last eight verses of the Torah, which begins with the word Vayamat Moshe Rabbeinu died. It was written after Moshe Rabbeinu, that was written by Yeshua, his disciple. So it says that those forgotten souls, that's where they're connected to. We have this in the Midbar also. It says in the desert, all the tribes traveled within the clouds of glory. There were certain people who were had sunken so low that and they were connected with the golden calf and the micha, etc. Whole thing. They were particularly from the tribe of Dan, actually, that the clouds of glory ejected them, and they got thrown out of the camp. And they were these souls that were so forgotten and so forlorn that they were sort of beyond redemption.
They are beyond redemption.
Since they appear to be beyond redemption. Okay. No one is beyond redemption.
Okay, good.
Right. Moshe Rabbeinu couldn't redeem these souls. Because Moshe Rabbeinu was a symbol of purity. Like other versions. And sometimes the tzaddik cannot reach those souls. The tzaddik who is always pure is too pure to reach those souls, cannot reach those souls. Those souls were represented, the Mishkan is a model of Bnei Yisrael. We've talked about this before, right? Make me a Mishkan, I will dwell within them. Because the Mishkan is just a model for our own Mishkan. Those souls are represented by the hooks of the courtyard. Because the hooks of the courtyard are the hooks that hang just outside the Mishkan. The pillars of the Mishkan that hang behind. When Moshe Rabbeinu did an accounting of the Mishkan, he didn't know where the hooks were. He couldn't relate to those hooks. Right? Says the Medrash, and added to by the Megal HaMukos, that at that point Rabbi Akiva's soul appeared to Moshe Rabbeinu. And Rabbi Akiva, because he was Akiva, who was Rabbi Akiva? Rabbi Akiva was not like Moshe Rabbeinu. Rabbi Akiva was a convert. Rabbi Akiva not only was a convert, his ancestry was not such a good ancestry. He came from Sisera. If you know a bit of Tanakh, you know Sisera was an enemy of the Jewish people. Right? The Zohar says that the Sisera was the symbol of klipa, of impurity. But somehow in that purity, sometimes in the depths of impurity, gets trapped a lofty soul that is totally trapped, waiting for redemption, but so hard to redeem because it's so trapped. Right? It came out in redemption with Rabbi Akiva when his father converted. Rabbi Akiva had a rough life. Rabbi Akiva was ignoramus till he was 40. He was a nothing, I mean, seemingly. And he became Rabbi Akiva, right? The soul of Rabbi Akiva appears to Moshe Rabbeinu and says, you want to know where the remaining silver is? In the hooks. The lost souls. Right? But it goes further. Hold on a second. Okay. The lost souls, that's where it is. Because even those souls belong to the Mishkan. There might be the hooks hanging just outside, but they belong to the Mishkan. Because sometimes it takes even a greater power. It comes from Moshe Rabbeinu. But it cannot be Moshe Rabbeinu. It's all connected to Moshe Rabbeinu. Rabbi Akiva wasn't independent. He was a hemshech. Was a continuation of Moshe Rabbeinu. But it takes a revelation of even a greater power, the power that can descend. The lower something can descend, the higher it comes. And therefore, it's a power that can descend even the lowest of the low and redeem even those souls. Rabbi Akiva can do that because he was the symbol of Akiv. He was the soul that could redeem those hooks hanging on the Mishkan. This concept is also connected to a very interesting thing. You know the idea of a leap year, right? So now we're in a leap year. Every couple of years we have a leap year. When's the leap year? The leap year is always the extra month is Adar, correct? Interestingly enough, the leap year, the extra month, is always the month of Purim. What's the idea behind a leap year, spiritually speaking? So the 12 months of the year represent the 12 tribes. So where does the 13th month come into it? The 13th month are these lost souls. Right? Every couple of years, we have an extra month to redeem the lost souls. Which is why, and by the way, the number 13 is very relevant here. Because we know what is the redemption of lost souls. The redemption of lost souls comes through the idea of tshuva. Right? That's the idea of the difference between a tzaddik and a baal tshuva. The tzaddik is pure. The person who does tshuva is the person who's able to take the negativity of the challenge and overcome it and redeem it. How does that happen? We know where's the source of tshuva. The source of tshuva comes from the 13 principles of mercy. The Yud Gimel Midot Rachamim, that's number 13. So the 13th month is where the revelation of the 13th Midot Rachamim take place. Right? Which is why the 13th month is always one with Purim. Because Purim is the same idea. What is Purim? Purim is the redemption of the lowest of the low. We know that, the famous thing, we always talk about this with regard to Purim. Purim is the yontif of concealment. It's the yontif where God is totally concealed. That's why the Megillah doesn't have God's name. Right? The miracle is a natural miracle. They remain subjects of Ahasuerus. We don't have time to go into great length now, but there's a lot of aspects about Purim that show that Purim actually, and Purim itself is not even a yontif. I mean, yontif in terms of not being able to do stuff like drive and cook and all that. Right? It's a regular day, it's a weekday. Why? Because Purim was the yontif that happened during exile. Because Purim is the yontif which revealed such a deep root in the Jew's soul that could come and redeem even the Jew that's in the darkest of the dark. Even the Jew that's in a Megillah that has not God's name. Right? That's the power of Purim. That's why it comes in the third month. And that's why it's all got to do, these lost souls have to do with the concept of the hooks. Why? Have a look at the pasuk again. It says that from these 1,700 and whatever it was, they made the hooks for the pillars, right? How do you spell the word hook in Hebrew? So there's two spellings. One is vav vav, because a hook in Hebrew is vav. In fact, the letter vav also looks like a hook, right? So that's why it's called vav. So vav vav. Vav, vav, the numerical value of vav is 6. 6 times 6 is 12. 6 and 6 is 12, right? So as Moshe Rabbeinu forgot the hooks, he couldn't. Why? Because Moshe Rabbeinu only related to the 12 tribes. But there's another spelling of the word Vav. Another way to spell Vav is Vav Aleph Vav. Vav Aleph Vav, it is the third, it's the hidden Aleph. If you spell it in full, it's Vav Aleph Vav.
Is that how it's spelled?
No, it's spelled Vav Vav. That's why Moshe Rabbeinu forgot it. Because he could only relate to the 12. But when the heavenly voice said, there's the hidden Aleph that you forgot about. There's the hidden souls, and that was revealed to Moshe Rabbeinu, and that was the message that there's no soul that cannot be redeemed. It needs Rabbi Akiva. Just to finish off quickly, because we have 2 minutes, just tell you about Rabbi Akiva's amazing thing. There's an amazing concept. You know that on Rosh Hashanah, when we blow the shofar, right? And shofar is the symbol of tshuva, right? Of returning home. What's the idea of shofar Rosh Hashanah? It's the cry from the depths of the soul that no matter how far I've gone, I'm coming home, right? That's the symbol of shofar. So we know that there's a minag. I mean, according to the Torah, you only have to blow 9 blasts, but there's a minag, a custom that on Rosh Hashanah we blow 100 sounds, right? You know, the 100 sounds. Where does this come from, 100 sounds? It's a very bizarre source. The source for 100 sounds is this, that in the Torah, which tells us to blow shofar. If you look at the Targum, the translation of blowing the shofar, it says Yevava. The cry of the shofar is called Yevava. Yevava is like a cry, right? So the sound of a shofar in Aramaic is Yevava. Where do we also find the terminology of Yevava? The terminology is that in the story of Sisera, okay, where Sisera's son got killed by Yael and saved the Jewish people. And it says afterwards there was the song of Dvorah, right? And then it says that the mother of Sisera was looking for, like it's a almost a cruel thing. Yevava, the mother of Sisera was waiting for Sisera, Vatayavev em Sifra, and mother of Sisera was crying, waiting for Sisera to come home, which obviously never came home because he was killed. Good thing he was killed, because that saved the whole Jewish nation, right? And it says there in the Medrash that the mother of Sisera has used the same term, Yevava, crying, and it says she cried 100 times. That's why there's a minute to cry. On the face of, and the Tosfos says this in Gemara, on the face of it, it's a bizarre thing. Well, because some wicked woman, Yisra Sisera, cried 100 times for a poor son Sisera, who was the persecutor of the Jewish nation, so we should blow 100 sounds of the shofar in Rosh Hashanah. It's ridiculous. The answer is no. That's the whole point. Sisera was the embodiment of klipa, of impurity. Rabbi Akiva comes from Sisera, and therefore from the mother of Sisera, right? She cried 100 times. Why she cried 100 times? Because in her there was this trapped soul of a forgotten soul, a forgotten trapped soul, which at that point was embodied in the cloth of impurity. Later on, those 100 sounds were redeemed by Rabbi Akiva. Rabbi Akiva redeemed that soul. He was the symbol of redemption of these lost souls. Nothing can be more perfect than Rosh Hashanah to do that. On Rosh Hashanah, we blow 100 sounds, because that's the whole idea. The idea of Rosh Hashanah is, the power of the shofar is, that it can take the furthest Jew and bring him back. Good.